I think we have a duty, all of us, to be informed. And it's easy to get caught up in the 5-minute or 5-second soundbite on television and not make time to be informed. But it's a civic duty, it's a civic obligation, particularly in a time of disruption, to do that. And that is certainly a recommendation I would make for all of us, individually and collectively.
That was Daniel Wagner, and this is the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to another episode of the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. This is where we do long-form conversations about risk, about uncertainty, about randomness. I talk to interesting risk takers, decision makers, and I also have big picture conversations of the type that I'm bringing you today. A Merry Christmas, a Happy Holidays, and peace to you all wherever you happen to be listening. I hope you're enjoying the holidays and that perhaps you're taking a little bit of time to reflect on things, to spend some time with friends and family, and or to do some stuff that you truly enjoy. Today's episode is a look back at 2017 and a look forward to 2018 in terms of big picture risks. My guest is Daniel Wagner, who joins me for a record fourth time on the podcast. And if you caught any of the first three episodes, you'll know that Daniel is an expert in geopolitical risk. He's a commentator in various media outlets around the world. He's the CEO of his firm Country Risk Solutions. And he is an author of several books and articles, most recently of a book called Virtual Terror, which is about cyber warfare. You can listen to episode 57 of the All Things Risk podcast to learn a little bit more about that. Daniel was in London a few weeks ago, and we caught up to record this episode, which is basically a conversation about some of Daniel's reflections on the biggest risks and events of 2017, and a look forward to 2018, a number of big picture risks that don't seem to be on people's radars, but in Daniel's view, probably should. And I don't want to give these away to you in the intro, but suffice it to say that we talk US politics, the Middle East, cryptocurrencies, North Korea, China, and the global economy in what was a pretty wide-ranging and interesting conversation, as you probably gathered. So let's cast our gaze backwards and then forwards with Daniel Wagner. Enjoy. Daniel, welcome back to another episode of the All Things Risk podcast, and you are... Now you've got the record, so you're a four-time guest, so really brilliant to have you back.
It's great to be back, Ben.
So we're going to have a little bit of some reflections. I'd like to get your reflections on how the year went from a risk perspective and then look forward to next year. You always have some very interesting insights. So you're a contrarian and you come up with some wonderful things that people should be thinking about that probably aren't. So maybe we could just start with 2017. Has anything surprised you in the last year?
Well, a lot of things have. Part of what surprised me, I think, is the consistency of the ongoing nature of disruption in global politics, global economy, etc. You know, we've gotten to a stage, I think, where this is the new normal, where turning things upside down, maybe not necessarily in a good way, has become something that we should expect. Of course, people will instantly think about Mr. Trump and how he's totally upending things in the States. And of course, depending on which side of the spectrum you're on, you're going to think that's either a good thing or a terrible thing. My view is it's an inevitable thing, and it's something that the U.S. needs very badly because the system is terribly broken. And if it takes someone who's so outrageous in some respects and a bit of a bull in a china shop, and you know, never mind what his personality is like or some of the quirks of his personality, I think he's actually performing something that's really important for America. And it's going to take a lot of people a while to wake up to what is really happening and what it all means. But my take is, I don't particularly care for the message or how it's being delivered or the messenger, but I'm glad that there is a disruptive message being delivered in America. And I think a lot of other places could use it. Mm. It's part of the cycle that we undergo. We may not necessarily consider it, but think about it for a second in the States. I mean, having been through the civil rights era, for example, in the 60s, and all these types of disruptive parts of American history, we haven't had this type of disruption in a while. And this is a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
And at least back in those days, there was some predictability about how this is going to all unwind, because, you know, America had not changed dramatically for quite some time, and you were still in a very simple era, this sort of Ozzie and Harriet period, transitioning through to the 60s, transitioning through onto the 70s, etc. Since then, I mean, we've had a little ups and downs, but nothing truly significant, and I think we're overdue. You could probably say that about a lot of other places in the world. The question in my mind becomes, will they be disrupted? How? When? It's not really a question of if.
Sure, sure. Are you hopeful then, because Americans will turn around and say, how did we get to this place and how do we unwind it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say we earned it, first of all. Those of you who will be familiar with today's America as compared with what America was even 10 or 20 years ago, it's hardly recognizable in some respects, and it's hard to really define what American culture is today. I'm hoping that this whole exercise, certainly for the Trump era, whether that's for a year or 8 years, I hope it will be productive in the sense that it succeeds in truly draining the swamp and upending things. If it's really just a question of him being a blip on the radar and everything goes back to what it was, I would be gravely disappointed.
Well, that is perhaps a risk, though, because, you know, that is all looking very comforting, even though, you know, you're sort of the devil you know, right? And the other thing that, from a non-US perspective, that is frightening is, well, this is the first time we've had this type of a president with the finger on the button in the nuclear era. So the last time it wasn't such a global issue, and it is now.
Well, that's a fair point, and I think it's also worth adding that it's also the first time that, if we use North Korea, for example, that you've had a president saying to a member of the Kim family, no, we're not appeasing you anymore. Here's the line that's being drawn. Here's the fleet that's sitting outside your waters, and if you want to dance, let's dance. That's very interesting, and if you notice, the reaction that Kim Jong-un has had has been pretty quiet. And we'll see if that lasts, and nobody really expects it to. But there's a lot of people in America who like the fact that that type of appeasement is no longer going on. And my own view on the North Korea issue, for what it's worth, is that we bear a lot of the blame for where we are today. We, America, we the West. You know, there's the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and other treaties that have basically said that, you know, nuclear technology is going to be shared, and then we didn't end up sharing it collectively, and so other people wanted to find clandestine ways to get it, and then we saw the direction the Kims were going, and we just sort of looked the other way or hoped it wouldn't get worse, et cetera. And instead of nipping it in the bud, when it could have been nipped in the bud at the outset decades ago, we didn't do it. So my view is we certainly bear part of the blame. But getting back to the original point, I think that there's a lot of nostalgia for the way things used to be. And a lot of Trump supporters, they wish things could be that Ozzie and Harriet way, right, again, even though that's never coming back. They don't like what America has become. Prior to the election, I was on a panel in New York with three guys from the foreign exchange world, and inevitably the question came up from the crowd, who do you think's going to win? So the three FX guys said Hillary, and I said Trump. And I said, he's struck a nerve, and it cannot be ignored, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if he gets in. Now, that said, it wouldn't also surprise me at all if he has two terms, as astonishing as that may sound. The reason I say that is, he's a smart enough guy to know how close to get and how close not to get to things that could become explosive.
Mm-hmm.
And the Russia investigation mm-hmm. and the interference in the elections is certainly one of those. I wouldn't be surprised at all if people around him get caught up in the net, but he doesn't.
Hmm. That's interesting. That's an interesting prediction and viewpoint. Let's maybe turn our attention to the geopolitical space. And so the Russia investigation is going on here in the UK. All kinds of revelations about Russia having interfered supposedly in the Brexit vote. Trump has just come back from Asia, where there's been the APEC summits and so forth. And this has been brewing for a long time, but the post World War II institutions and structures, where they were talking about Bretton Woods and the trade infrastructure around the world, the also arguably the human rights regimes and all of those things, they seem to be either crumbling or under extreme pressure. And the question I have is, what has happened in the last year? Where are we with that in the last 12 months? What is your take on that?
On the reason why these things seem to be imploding?
So I guess the overall question is, are we heading towards a world where none of that stuff really matters anymore? International norms don't matter anymore. The global trade regime really doesn't matter that much anymore. All the rules that we set up at the end of the Second World War, that they don't matter anymore. It's all about, you know, it's power politics. It's mercantilism again. It's that kind of a world versus something resembling some type of international norms that kind of underpin the rules in which states work with each other.
Yeah, okay, so that's a fair question, really interesting question as well to examine. I think part of the reason why this is happening is that the institutions themselves and the norms that have been established have not kept pace with the change that's going on around them. If we look, for instance, at the UN, the UN was set up as a post-World War II institution with these, you know, five permanent members, which leaves outside the circle, you know, the Brazils and Indias and other countries which really matter. Mm-hmm. And even to this day, that hasn't changed. Even having raised the issue about how outdated and inappropriate that approach is now. Look at the multilateral development banks. Of course, they've served a very useful purpose and they continue to. But why would China, right, which is the world's second largest economy, soon to be the largest, which should by all definitions be a net lender mm-hmm. instead of a net recipient of their aid, why should it be receiving any aid from mm-hmm. them, mm-hmm. right? And so for these institutions to take a hard look at themselves and say, you know what, if we don't have China to lend to anymore, that's a very significant chunk of the lending pie. Mm-hmm. And what do we do if there's no China to take that money anymore? These smaller countries, mm-hmm. they don't have the ability to absorb mm-hmm. that capacity, that level of lending. These are some fundamental questions that these institutions need to ask themselves, and I don't think they're very interested in asking the questions or finding out what the answers are, because it may then, as in the case of the UN, require taking a really close look at, you know, should we have the type of structure in place about ownership and all these other things. Mm-hmm. As for some of the other issues, human rights, etc., that stuff matters, but I think people are just overwhelmed by the pace of change more generally. Mm. And because of the news cycle and the amount of information that's thrown at everybody, I think people just don't exactly know where to focus. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like you have to prioritize how much information you can absorb personally in a given day and what's worth looking at and what you really want to focus in on. I think, you know, humanitarian organizations have a real challenge on their hands because there's a lot of competition for a limited amount of resources that didn't previously exist, and they're having to grapple with that as well.
That always seems to happen on the back of a big natural disaster. The coordination doesn't seem to be there, and you've talked about climate change before, and we seem to be heading to a place where, you know, we've had a number of storms this year, in certainly in your part of the world, and that will, it feels like that is going to continue. And if we don't get our house in order, and as you talk, you know, you've spoken about before, we could be in for some difficult times around the world.
We certainly could, and we will. There's mm-hmm. been a projection from the OECD that if climate change goes on as it has gone on and anticipated to go on in the future, that in some of our lifetime, in say 50 years, many of the world's financial centers, which are based yeah. on the coasts, yeah. and many of those in Asia, they're going to be underwater. And I mean, it seems like a doomsday prediction, and hopefully it won't come true, but Miami has yes. routine flooding already, if yes. the moon is aligned correctly, yes. et cetera. So I don't know, you know, it's easy to poo-poo such predictions and say, you know, this is a once-in-a-century event, but we've had, in the sure. case of the U.S. and some other parts of the sure. world, we've had once-in-a-century, once-in-a-thousand-year events multiple sure. times in the space of a year.
Sure. Now, I want to transition to something here, because a number of your compatriots deny that climate change is going on. And similarly, you know, this the Oxford Dictionary of the year last year was post-truth, and we seem to be, and I don't know if I'm noticing this, it was always there, but I'm starting to notice it, but when you have flat earthers and all kinds of conspiracies that seem to, you know, perpetuate online, and you've got a president that's calling the mainstream media fake news, has this always been there, or are we entering a new phase where people are just choosing what to believe, when to believe it?
That's really part of the danger of what we're facing going forward, is that in this era where there's been so much data produced in a given year, there was so much produced in 2014 and 2015 that it surpassed all the previous data that's ever been produced. And now that we've got, you know, projected 50 billion smartphones in the world by 2020, it's just information overload, and people sure. have the ability, anyone has the ability to yeah. be a journalist now.
Yes.
You got a cell phone, turn on your video, yes. you're a journalist. Send it into, you know, any number of news organizations, yes. you get credited, and all of a sudden, you know, you're the source of this yes. thing. I mean, you know, that's the reality today. Mm-hmm. It can be used for good, or it can be used
There's
for evil.
There's an upside to it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure there is. I think it's just part of the new reality, and you have mm-hmm. to roll with the punches. Mm-hmm. I would like to believe that people will ultimately see what some of the possibilities are with the information that we now have at our fingertips, mm-hmm. tips, and we'll use it for meaningful outcomes. Mm-hmm. Now, some people, of course, won't. But I'm really intrigued, and as you know, because we spoke earlier this year about my new book, Virtual Terror, and the whole cyber question. Yeah. One of the things that intrigues me so much about cyber, continues to, is how difficult it is to prove anything that anyone did yes. or didn't do on the internet.
Yes.
Right? And, you know, we're at the beginning yes. of the 21st century. Can you imagine?
It's going to get weird, isn't it?
It's going to get really weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. We can, you know, there was that that video that went around of Obama speaking, but it wasn't Obama. So, you know, we talked about photoshopping before, but now we're going to be able to create videos of people doing things that, you know, they aren't doing.
And isn't that going to make elections rather interesting going forward?
Very interesting. We've got artificial intelligence mm-hmm. that is coming up and doing all kinds of strange things, potentially virtual reality. So I could just detach from all of this. And I think I will spend my time on a virtual beach. And,
that idea.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what it's also doing is it's transforming the nature of risk.
Yes.
Because we had the ability not so long ago to consider what the possibilities were based on the past and the present, having some reasonable expectation about what the future would be.
Yeah.
Well, we're quickly losing that.
We are.
Because the pace of change is going on so rapidly and dynamically and unpredictably.
Got to think about things differently.
We do. Mm-hmm. We have to change our mindset. But for those of us who are in the future prediction business, it's really getting very interesting. Mm-hmm. And we have to imagine the unimaginable almost on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And the challenge of being accurate mm-hmm. in predicting that is becoming ever more challenging.
It is, and almost at the point where perhaps we shouldn't try, but we are going to try in a moment to talk about next year. But before we do, was there anything else in 2017 that kind of took you aback, that you didn't expect, that you didn't quite see coming?
I think it's the nature of some of the changing bilateral relationships that are really surprising. For example, that Turkey is now an ally with Russia and is buying Russian arms as a NATO member, right? That's, I mean, unimaginable 6 or even 12 months ago. Mm-hmm. The idea that Turkey is now having a tit-for-tat, you know, visa war with its citizens, meaning you don't hand over this guy Gul in Pennsylvania, well, I'm not going to let your citizens in anymore. I mean, the very idea that states that were, until very recently, close allies are now challenging each other in some pretty fundamental ways, I think is absolutely fascinating. We look at the fall of Mobutu in, sorry, not Mobutu, but Mugabe in Zaire. Yes. I'm losing track of all my African leaders. I wonder what took them all so long. I wonder what in the era of social media, why the Zimbabwean people did not rise up and overthrow this man years ago, when the Arab Spring and the Arab Awakening and all these movements 5-6 years ago were happening. Why did they not do that? Mm. What is it about his hold over these people? It's sort of like some former Nazis, I'm not making an appropriate comparison, but some former Nazis saying, look, what is it that allowed 1,000 people in a concentration camp to be ruled by a few dozen people that prevented them from rising up? And I guess it's a similar question in a way. When you have the ability to communicate with your brethren through social media, is there an excuse for not rising up?
Yes.
I mean, that really is a very interesting question. If you take that question and you apply it to so many other places in the world that you would think would be ripe for fundamental political change, I'm really sort of wondering when it's next going to crop up. I think his passing from the scene hopefully will inspire people to do something similar throughout the African continent.
A lot of those guys around him are still there.
Yeah.
And that it's going to, if you looked at the, this is kind of fresh, so this will probably go out a few weeks afterwards, but the interviews and the celebrations in Harare, and there's certainly a lot of hope, but how long before that hope starts to fade?
Well, it is interesting that the new leader who took over was the former VP and had presided over, you know, the internal state repression for many years, and now all of these people are celebrating that he's taken over. I don't think they expect him to be the permanent leader. I would love for there to be an old-fashioned kind of revolution in that place. They really deserve to have, you know, the kind of leader that should be leading them.
They do. No, a lot of interesting stuff. I was, you know, there's that old, was it the Stanley Milgram experiment with the prisoners and the guards, and, you know, how such a small group of people can, you know, can control a much larger group of people, and how people let that happen. So some things don't change, you know.
Well, I think that's exactly right. You would think, or maybe it's that people are still getting used to this whole social media platform and what the possibilities are. But most people around the world have smartphones now, and they get what this is all about. So I'm sort of wondering why it is that we don't have more radical change. And yet, if we did have that kind of radical change on an ongoing basis, how on earth would we manage it?
Yes, that is another great question. And I want to talk perhaps a little bit about the whole fake news phenomenon and whether or not Russia had much to do with that. But it does strike me as entirely within the realms of possibility that it is possible to influence people via what they see on their screens and how they react, and And I would have thought that somebody like Putin and the Russians, who are very good at, you know, information dissemination and KGB techniques, that they would excel at that.
I don't think there's any doubt personally mm-hmm. that they did do what they're accused of doing. But because, you know, the net is a anonymous, borderless, lawless world, there's not a shred of evidence. Mm-hmm. And the head of the CIA under Obama, before he left mm-hmm. in January of this year, basically went before Congress and said, we've been looking at this. We don't have any proof. Mm-hmm. And
if you know, they did, the deed is done anyway.
So. Well, but you have to hand it to Putin mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. co. And others who might be engaged in that process. And that is that, well, they've found something which is really interesting and useful, yes. and they've mastered how to yes. manipulate it. I also think it's worth saying that it's a little bit rich for Americans to be so outraged sure. that this has happened, when in fact it's been proven that, you know, the American government has been interfering in lots of other people's elections sure. for decades. Sure. And so it doesn't feel very good when it comes home to roost. Why would anyone like that? No one would. But I don't think there's any reason to believe that Putin and co. are going to change their tune on that. Very unpredictable outcomes. Mm-hmm. I think they certainly got a very different bill of goods than they anticipated mm-hmm. out of all of this, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And yet, mission accomplished, yeah. Assuming we understand what the mission originally was. But imagine what would happen if lots of other governments started doing this with lots of other governments' elections. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just a Russia issue. It was maybe America doing it, or China doing it, or North sure. Korea, et cetera. Because, as we know, you know, these other countries have the ability to punch well above their weight in the cyber arena, North Korea being the most prime example. Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of mindful that we may just be at the end of the runway mm-hmm. on this. And if you consider the possible implications of that kind of interference where there is no proof, mm-hmm. and yet you don't necessarily know what the outcome of those actions was, because yes. you don't know exactly what the actions were, I mean, it's yes. mind-boggling.
Yes, it is. It is. Let's maybe turn our attention to 2018, because I think that's a good segue, you know, the runway analogy. And what are some of the things that are on your mind when it comes to big risks in 2018 that perhaps we aren't really thinking about enough?
There's so many, it's hard mm-hmm. to even mm-hmm. put them in some kind of order, but I'll give you a few. Sure. I've put a little thought right. into this. The first is the Saudi experiment. Mm-hmm. And I do consider it an experiment mm-hmm. because if you look at what Mohammed bin Salman, the MBS, mm-hmm. is trying to do, on one hand, you want to congratulate him and saying, wow, we very much need some some meaningful reform in Saudi yes. Arabia. On the other, some of the other previous initiatives mm-hmm. that have been made under the Saudi leadership to, for instance, create new cities and undertake new expensive initiatives, they haven't worked very well no. because you need a sustainable high oil price to do that. And I think to the extent that the oil price, if it were to keep rising and it were to rise and sustain at 100 or above, which is not a sustainable price, I don't think. Probably 70 or 80 is a sustainable price, and that would be considered rather high. To the extent that that happens for any length of time, then maybe he's got a chance of getting some real leverage on some of these initiatives. But if you look at the NEOM city that he is planning in, you know, on the Red Sea, it stands for New Economic Operating Model. You know, where does $500 billion, which is probably a modest projection, where does $1 trillion come from to pay for this?
Right.
With yes. all the other issues that are going on, I think I had published a piece not long ago said, you know, is it a really enlightened vision, or is it a pipe dream? And that, of course, is going to remain to be seen. But it is interesting to look at how the sands are shifting in the Middle East with the alliance now apparently informal on an intelligence/back channel basis between Israel and Saudi Arabia mm-hmm. against Iran. Mm-hmm. I think the sands are going to continue to shift for some time to come. Now that the Syria conflict is reaching some sort of a conclusion that many people did not expect, now that as a result of ISIS sort of falling somewhat by the wayside, I think they're going to go promote virtual jihad, and they're not going to die. They're just going to...
And they're very capable of doing that.
Very, very capable of doing that, and that's what's going to happen. That's going to open up a whole new can of worms as well. But I also think that to the extent that the Arab awakening is largely over, or at least on hold for the time being, now that the Syria conflict has been resolved, I think we're going to see the periscope now focus again on Israel and Palestine and the perennial problem there. And that will become a focus, I think, in the next year, certainly more than it has been. I think in between rounds of golf, Mr. Trump seems to think to believe that he can snap his fingers and resolve this. But I think it will be coming back on the burner. So that's something certainly worth watching. And then, of course, the whole Qatar thing, the embargo, and whether that sticks together. And then the Yemen question, which has been, you know, a really sad, unfortunate disaster, humanitarian disaster. It's been the largest in recent history. I don't know. I think there's no end to what MBS thinks he can do. Now he thinks, in recent headlines, he's been talking about, you know, fighting terrorism more generally in all of its forms, and yet not recognizing the role that Wahhabism plays in promoting that, et cetera.
And so to that point, what do you think about the internal stability of Saudi Arabia?
I don't have any reason to believe at this stage that it is under threat. I think there will be a backlash for what MBS did with the princes and other members of the royal family. But most Saudis, I presume, are going to applaud that. Whether it's meaningful or not remains to be seen. Do you buy your way, if you're Prince Al-Walid, out of this problem by handing over 70 or 80% of your wealth? And is that the end of the story? I presume not. And then it would be very easy to be cynical about this and say this was all really just a ploy to put money in the coffer to promote NEOM and some other objectives of MBS. I don't know what to think. I think it's too early to say. It was interesting to me also that Jared Kushner had been in Riyadh just the week prior to all of this happening. And you do wonder just what kind of backroom machinations are going on and who's giving winks and nods and, you know... Yeah. I'm intrigued by it, and I don't necessarily have more insight than anyone else into what this is, because I think it's just too early to say.
Sure.
But it wouldn't be surprising to me if MBS takes the formal reins of power in the coming weeks or months.
Okay.
And I think we should look out for that.
Okay. What's next on your list?
So let's talk about cryptocurrencies.
Yes.
Fascinating to me that so many people could be jumping on the cryptocurrency bandwagon purely out of greed. Right? You have a Bitcoin, for example, which was under $100 when it started, and it's just breaking through 9,000. 3 months ago when I published the book, it had just broken through, broken through 9,000. 3 months ago, it had broken through 3,000. So it's tripled in just 3 months. I don't know. You either have to believe that this is truly the next thing and it really has legs, or it's going to be coming crashing down spectacularly. I wrote a piece recently saying that the average investor really should be thinking twice about this because of the wild gyrations, but also because there's been more and more theft of cryptocurrencies that are reaching the headlines now, and not just of Bitcoin, of Ethereum and others as well. And
it's a great thing to steal, because once you have it, there's no way of tracking it.
But let's think about this for a second. The great appeal, one of the great appeals of cryptocurrencies is that they're supposed to be, you know, theft proof, and all these algorithms are supposed to mean that you're not going to be able to have access to them, and this is, you know, just some wizard back there in the crypto world who controls all this stuff. But what it shows and what it sort of reaffirms is that anything can be created in the crypto world can be hacked. And so it's nice to think you get on this crypto train and you make all this great money, and all you have to do is just sort of lie back and watch it rise and rise and rise. And it may do that, may continue to do that. It may raise $500,000 for a Bitcoin. I don't know. Some people project that. But I'm, you know, I'm a risk guy, and like you, and I'm concerned about, you know, people losing sight of the fact that there are risks attached to this, and they're just getting these dollar signs in their eyes and being greedy.
Yes. I think that's what's driving a lot of it right now. Because if you look at the fundamentals, it's, you know, a currency is a means of exchange or a store of value. So what's happened in the last 6 months that suggests that more people are using Bitcoin for to buy things?
We should bear in mind, and I brought this up in the article, I said, remember, one of the reasons why this cryptocurrency concept has really caught fire, apart from the rise in the value, is that it's primarily used by cyber criminals.
Right.
And so you have to ask yourself, what kind of company do you want to keep?
Right.
Not that you're a cyber criminal if you trade in Bitcoin, but 57% of Bitcoin transactions are done by criminals.
And you have to think that at some point, you know, states will regulate this stuff much more.
To the extent that they can.
Yes.
Can they? This is taking place on the dark web. And until and unless there are, first of all, rules which will govern how all that works, and then you have the ability to find the person and then apprehend and then prosecute. We're so far away from that that I think at some point in time that may happen, but certainly not next year.
Sure, sure. But still, I mean, it does look like it's a speculative bubble. That's what I think. But and I'm just looking for the signs around that. So I got invited to participate in an ICO, initial coin offering. And I don't know why they chose me, because, or they went after me, because I don't know anything about this, very little about this sort of stuff. So it just kind of suggests to me that, you know, a lot of the ICOs aren't really being taken up anyway. And it just suggests to me you've got a lot of people wanting in on the action but don't really understand what the product is about. And that to me is a,
I think people are intrigued. It's the new thing. And again, people don't really understand it. They don't really necessarily think they need to understand it. You just get on the investment gravy train. Some in some regards, it's just that simple. But just remember that these currencies, they support a lot of nasty types of businesses, right? You know, child pornography and, you know, selling arms to nasty people and drugs trade and all sorts of stuff. And I don't know. I find the whole thing distasteful.
But okay.
Maybe I'm just old-fashioned. I don't
know. Right. Well, we'll see. We'll see how that plays out.
Well, on the cyber thing, let's talk a little bit also about the cyber warfare.
Yes.
And I'm thinking that next year is going to be a year that'll be, if not pivotal, certainly important in the progression of cyber warfare, because the wars of the future are going to be fought in space and in cyberspace. And more and more governments, the ones that matter in this arena, the Chinas, Americas, and Russias of the world, they're ramping up.
Right.
And so there was a treaty from 1967 that basically said that space will not be weaponized. But these governments are saying, you know what, that was then and this is now. We didn't have the ability really so much to weaponize them, or certainly not the way we do today. And now we do. And I'm increasingly thinking that, you know, conventional wars, they're not going to be a thing of the past, but they're becoming less important in terms of how battles are fought. So I think next year is going to be very interesting in the progression of cyber warfare. I'm not happy to be able to say that, but that's the direction that we're going. I think it's just one of those paradigms that's changing and metamorphosizing at a rapid rate.
So what would be an example of a cyber warfare event, if you like, or cyber warfare incident, a big hack of a, I don't know, national database or of infrastructure or...
Sure, that's exactly the sort of thing. I mean, you know, interestingly enough, and it doesn't please me to use this example, but back in, I think, 2009 or 2011, Israel had its national database hacked and all of its citizens, you know, sensitive information stolen. Right. This is Israel we're talking about, right? Like, not a neophyte nation.
Sure.
And, of course, you look at the hacks that have already happened in America, you know, the Office of Personnel Management and the SEC, et cetera. I mean, it's mind-boggling in the breadth. That information is out there. If you think also in terms of the American context, every adult American, every working age American has already had their personal information compromised. If whoever took it wanted to use it in some fashion, they certainly could. There are many cyber bugs that have been placed in infrastructure around the world.
Yes.
And, you know, if some sort of a doomsday scenario happened and somebody wanted to trigger those, that can happen at any time. And a lot of the technology that governs how infrastructure operates today is 1970s era technology. you know, decades old and would take trillions of dollars to update this stuff, which is why it hasn't been done already. And so, you know, again, it's one of those things you want not to try to think about some of the possibilities based on what you may already know. But if someone were inclined to flick the switch and, you know, basically shut down an entire country's infrastructure grid, power, you know, trains, whatever it might be, that ability already exists.
Can you imagine if somehow someone shut off the ability of planes in the sky to communicate with each other and with, you know, with ground control and all the rest of that?
Yeah, that's certainly in the realm of possibility as well. I mean, it's interesting. Having read a lot on this subject of late, there's still public modes of public transportation that have the password the engineer uses to drive the train, you know, on a stick-it note on the console.
Yes.
Right? And when you think about, you know, just how vulnerable we are in that regard, that anybody who gains access to that, they don't have to hack it. It's sitting right there. It just makes you wonder. I think we can't worry too much about it, but the risk levels as a result of this transformation that is going on is mind-boggling. And for people who, you know, happen to be really knowledgeable about it and spend a lot of time thinking about it, they're scared out of their wits.
Sure, sure. Well, it will be an interesting year then if we do get a cyber warfare incident of some kind. But yeah, I'm hoping that doesn't happen. But very very important to call out the vulnerabilities.
Let me talk about a few sort of more local issues. Mm-hmm. Talk about the U.S. This congressional stagnation, which has gone on, is totally unsustainable. It's inexcusable for one thing, but it's unsustainable. I'm very curious to see what happens in 2018 in the midterms. So either the Dems are going to have the benefit from this backlash, and if Trump thinks he didn't get anything done in his first 2 years, imagine what the next 2 years would be like.
Sure.
Or, you know, we'll certainly have a much better idea about whether it's a one or a two-term Trump era at this point in time. My own view had been, and continues to be, that he will probably end up being a two-term president.
Wow. What drives that? Why do you say
that? I just think part of the reason is that the Democrats don't have their own house in order. They have these octogenarians running the show.
Yes.
They're part of the system that is broken.
Yes.
And I just think people are so angry that they're not willing to go back to business as usual. I wouldn't be surprised at all if there are some new political movements that crop up in the U.S. that basically tap into this. And Trump will in that regard, perhaps proven to have been the trigger that unleashed this political tsunami in the state. Because I'm not convinced that he himself is the tsunami. I think he's a change agent. So keep an eye on that. Where China is concerned, I don't think there's any doubt that it's China century. And I think that China is playing its card so deftly on so many areas that we're clearly going to see it continue to rise. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if next year sees a major consolidation. Now that Xi has had the Party Congress and, you know, he's definitely in power for the next 5 years, I think he's going to be set on really strengthening China's hand in the global political, economic, financial system, and he's poised to do so, and next year will be the first year that I think he's really going to ramp things up.
Well, One Belt, One Road is moving apace. We both lived in the Philippines for a time, and just the way in which all of a sudden that whole South China Sea thing, you know, shifted, he was, you know, it was a masterclass in geopolitical manipulation, if you like.
Well, I think you have to hand it to, you know, Putin and Xi in different ways, because they're being truly masterful in their craft. And you know, I think the world is quickly getting used to the idea that this is not the American century, it's the Chinese century, and China is quickly getting used to the idea that they need to, and it's in their interest to, step up to the plate, become, you know, more of a foreign aid donor, and, you know, wield their soft power stick and do all these various things to really flex their muscle on the world stage. And that's certainly happening and will continue to happen.
Interesting to see. Absolutely.
I think it's a pretty much guaranteed. I would not be at all surprised also if we see some talks for North Korea. Mm-hmm. Because Trump, I think, secretly wants to be able to say he broke bread with Kim. Now, Kim has said he's not going to have talks, but you know, I bet he's reassessing that.
Yes.
And my own prescription for that, frankly, believe it or not, would be to give Kim what he wants. Hmm. With some caveats attached. Okay. He's not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. His weapons aren't going anywhere. Mm-hmm. If anything, they're only going to become more advanced. Mm. My recommendation would be sit down in Pyongyang or wherever it needs to be, break bread, figure out a way to break this impasse, and give him a good portion of what it is that he wants, and in return, get some safeguards in place and some guarantees that, you know, certain things that are unacceptable to the West and the rest of the world simply will not happen. If there is some spirit of compromise, that can happen. But the idea...
Wouldn't that be a repeat of what Clinton did?
Well, yes and no. Mm-hmm. I mean, at that time, he wasn't a nuclear power.
True.
Right? And he didn't have the capabilities that he had. And you could, again, argue that a large part of the reason why he has them today is because we didn't, you know, the West collectively and his neighbors put their foot down strongly.
Yes.
That being said, you know, this is a different ballgame than Iran is. Iran didn't yet have the nuclear breakout. Mm-hmm. This guy's got the nuclear breakout. Mm-hmm. And there has never been a case where there's been a nuclear breakout and that nuclear nation has given up its nukes. You could say, well, wasn't Libya that way? Mm-hmm. But not really. It sort of maybe had the technology, but it didn't really have these advanced weapon systems and delivery capabilities and all that kind of stuff. So I'm hopeful that there can be a diplomatic solution to that imbroglio. Mm-hmm. I touched already on the likelihood that the price of oil is going to continue rising. Mm-hmm. The world, certainly from a consuming perspective, has benefited for several years now from, if you call it the depressed price of oil or the reasonable price of oil, the centrifugal forces that are in place with geopolitical and other forms of change are certainly pushing it in the direction of rising. Much will depend to what extent there are disruptions in the supply chain, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if the price of oil is in the 70s or the 80s next year. Right now, it's in the low 60s, so we should think about that as consumers. Mm-hmm. I have no reason to believe at this time, although I do find it unbelievable that the bull equity markets continue to go unabated.
Yes,
I mean If you look at history in terms of, you know, we're supposed to be having a recession now, and you know, we're supposed to be having a pullback, and did this unbridled optimism and this, you know, nothing can stop us kind of approach, and the greed, of course, that never died.
Well, I think some of that is driven by, you know, Trump's promise that, or you know, hinting that he'll pull back a lot of the regulations that you know, that frankly I think have helped safeguard the financial system. So if that's the driver, then look out. But
I think that's certainly part of the equation and the expectation of what will happen in the future. That said, the average consumer is going to suffer badly, I think, because, you know, the greed that never disappeared is certainly back in full force. And, you know, many of the indices are back at the levels that they were when everything imploded in 2007 and 2008. And I'm very concerned about that. I just think this era of unbridled greed and lax risk management and forgetting our lessons of history.
It goes in cycles, doesn't it?
It does. Well, we're due every 10 years. Yes. We're due for something like this. And so I'm not prepared to say that I think there will be a you know, U.S. or global recession next year, but there should be because... This just can't go on.
There was an article in the Financial Times recently about in mortgage lenders now in London, they'll or in the UK, but this was referring to London. They'll now allow you to take a mortgage on your home to, you know, buy Bitcoin, for instance.
Really,
which is not a not a wise thing to do. I wouldn't have thought, but
no, I wouldn't have thought either.
But you can do it. and there are people who are.
Well, that's shocking because, you know, the safeguards that have been put in place in the UK have not been dismantled, you know, since the Great Recession. So I'm wondering sort of how that's happening. I don't know.
I'd have to look into it, but it is possible if you want to mortgage your, you know, part of your home to, you know, to, well, I suppose you do whatever you want with that money, but people are buying Bitcoin with it. Some people are. So.
Well, I won't be among them.
No. good on you.
Just one or two other things to think about for next year. The continuation of political fractionalization. Mm-hmm. The idea that, you know, the widening of the disparity between rich and poor, the have and have nots, you know, the 1% and the little people, that's only going to get worse as long as, you know, something fundamental doesn't change. I don't know where the backlash comes out. You know, you look at London, for example, how just very expensive it is to live here for the average person.
It is.
And how people, you know, travel 2-3 hours sometimes on train to come into work. And
you can see the disparity as well. You've got housing estates alongside. I mean, we had this Grenfell fire, this big tower block that, you know, that is in a very posh neighborhood.
Mm.
And that is a great illustration of the problem.
Well, I find myself asking the question in the developed world, as I do in the developing and emerging world, how long these disparities can last before there is some sort of a mass backlash. I don't necessarily think that's going to happen next year, but certainly in the next decade, I would think that the chickens are going to come home to roost in some fashion, because the more difficult things become for the average person, the angrier they get. They no longer become patient. They, you know, they at some point reach their limit and they rise up. And so that's a sort of a longer term issue.
You can also trace the rise of Trump to the global financial crisis. I don't know how many, I think it was one or two people ever went to jail in the United States for fraud.
There was Bernie Madoff and then maybe one other guy. I think another problem is political apathy.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people simply aren't informed, or they don't care about the news, but other people are just too turned off by politics to even care.
Yes.
You know, they just figure, what difference is it going to make? You know, these people are never going to pay for their sins, etc.
It's hard to find a group of people doing what we're doing now, which is just having a conversation about politics and just talking about, just trying to be objective and see different perspectives. And that's no longer fun. When I was in high school and university, I participated in Model United Nations and model parliaments and things like this. And, you know, it was fun. And it doesn't seem, I don't know if that continues. I'm sure that continues. I would hope so, but just, we're not having conversations.
Well, the New York Times had a very simple recommendation for people over the recent Thanksgiving meal, and that was just don't talk politics at all, right?
Mm.
And how many divorces have occurred? How many decades-long friendships have broken up over politics? I don't know what it's descended to. I would hope that it can become an art form again, but I'm not entirely optimistic, at least not in the near term. One other issue is the continuation of disruption in all its forms.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said at the outset, I think that's primarily a good thing, right? If the system is broken and if things need to change and go their natural course, then I'm all for it. I guess the question is, how does that disruption happen? Is there any ability to predict it and or the outcomes? And to the extent that there is less and less of an ability to do so, I'm concerned about that. And that is certainly going to be an issue next year and well into the future.
Yes. Well, that's a great list. I don't know about great, but that's a very interesting list, and one that is going to provide people with a lot of food for thought. I want to, in the time that we have left, just talk a little bit about what people can do, what organizations can do, and what we all should be doing, perhaps as individuals. I know you've spoken to me about risk agility, and I think all of those lessons still apply, and probably, you know, more now than ever. But if you're working in an organization that's facing this sort of thing, we're all facing this sort of thing. But what should organizations first start to think about doing that they might not be doing in the midst of all of this stuff?
Let me first of all make a recommendation for individuals, and then I'll get to organizations. Mm-hmm. I think we have a duty, all of us, to be informed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to get caught up in the 5 minute or 5 second soundbite on television and not make time to be informed. But it's a civic duty, it's a civic obligation, particularly in a time of disruption, to do that. And that is certainly a recommendation I would make for all of us individually and collectively. As for organizations, well, there's just not a lot of bandwidth now, not a lot of room for error. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they have to get it right. Yes. And it becomes increasingly difficult to get it right at the same time. So more resources need to be devoted to risk management. More resources need to be devoted to security, cybersecurity, and you know, more traditional forms of security. I'm amazed that in the Londons and New Yorks of the world, most of the office buildings that you walk in, they, you know, they may have some sort of a sign-in, but, you know, there's no armed guard, and many of them do not, and, you know, there might be one layer or no layers of security. I've been in office buildings where, you know, the bag is checked, but the person is not, kind of thing, which didn't make any sense to me. I think organizations just need to spend a lot more time thinking about, in a commonsensical way, how they can make the workplace safer, how they can think more creatively and meaningfully about risk management issues more generally, how the people who make decisions need to integrate the people who help them understand risk management into the decision-making process instead of sending them out for biscuits. You know, these are some themes that we've talked about in the past, and as you say, they haven't changed. They've only become more important.
The decision-making one is crucial, and it's very hard to get done, mostly because, you know, people like you and I, we are contrarians, we'll challenge, we'll, you know, we're viewed sometimes as the police or the naysayers or, you know, this sort of thing. And we're just, we're not doing that. We're trying to help, you know, the business make a better decision. But it is a bit of a challenge when you have some organizations seemingly that still outsource their risk management, as opposed to, no, risk is part of how we should be making decisions and doing the work that we do.
You know, there are some cyber practitioners who suggest that organizations spend up to 10% of their revenue on cybersecurity. Very, very few organizations are going to do that, even if they could do that. Most who are switched on to cybersecurity spend maybe 3 or 4% if they're really devoted to the topic. I think businesses need to understand that spending money on cybersecurity is no longer a luxury. It's a necessity.
Yes.
And I would like to imagine that in the short term, businesses will graduate to the level where they don't have to have been hacked before they react. And proactivity is so very important in this regard. The technology is changing with rapidity, and if they're smart about how they spend their dollars or their pounds, they can get it done. But the stakes are so high now. I just think there's an existential threat for many businesses that get hacked. And even the reputation implications. Once you've lost that reputation, it's gone. You know, you're never getting it back.
Particularly if you're talking about customers' data.
Or security firms that get hacked themselves.
True.
Right? The Equifaxes of the world.
True. Absolutely.
Imagine, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Game over.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, well, let's maybe turn finally to individuals. I know you've talked a little bit about individuals, you know, being informed. I think that's crucial. Here's a thought I have, which is that I think on the upside of all of this stuff, the world, the way it is, and a lot, we have to turn our traditions. We have to rethink all these traditions that we have, and we were just talking about how wonderful it is now to be able to just write an article, a blog, or, you know, just create certain new income streams or new ways of doing things, new careers, all kinds of things. Possibilities now exist that didn't exist before. It's not for everyone, because you've got to be digitally connected, and there's a whole host of people around the world that don't have that access. But I think for a lot of people, certainly people that are listening to this, there are some great opportunities out there that didn't exist 5 years ago.
I would agree with that, and I would encourage people who are inclined to have a voice in the public domain to do so. You know, it's amazing. With self-publishing capabilities on platforms like Amazon and self-promotion, having your own blog, etc., or writing an article on a place like the Huffington Post where anybody can do it, you know, I think it's great to have a dialogue in written form and in a public form. I think the more people are communicating that way, the better off we're all going to be. And I would encourage people to find their voice if they think they have a voice. I can tell you that as an independent journalist, I've greatly benefited from having the ability to do that.
Yes.
And as a result of my recent experience publishing with Amazon, I'm a big fan of self-publishing and leaving the traditional publishers in the dirt, which is where I think they're going.
Well, that's probably a great note to maybe wrap it up on. Did want to ask you, do you have any books coming up in the next year or any projects that...
having published two books in the space of just about a year, I think I'm booked out for the moment.
Yes.
For me, I have to actually be really motivated to do it, and then I give it my all. I literally will take weeks or months off and spend seven days a week writing a book.
That was so well researched, and it was such a good overall, if you want a sense of what's out there, just a great picture of the players and the risks and, you know, I highly recommend that one.
I appreciate that. I mean, I've gotten really good feedback from it, and it's gotten great 5-star reviews on Amazon. So very pleased with that. But, you know, I'm all about making people educated, helping them become educated on topics of importance. And, you know, I'm intellectually curious. I don't think that's ever going to change. I think there will be another book at some point in time. Mm-hmm. I just don't know what that might be.
Sure.
I might have another project in the interim to occupy my time.
Sure.
We'll see.
Cool. Great stuff. We covered a lot. My goodness. An hour, but we really got into stuff and very broad and also a good deal of depth as well. So this was wonderful, as always. Before we wrap it up, for my listeners who might be new to you, how can they follow you and check you out and, you know, learn more about the stuff that you do?
Well, I put all my published work and media appearances on my website, countryrisksolutions.com. It's all there.
Perfect. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you. It was great to be with you again.
We've got to have you back as well. So, you've got an open invitation.
Anytime.
To add to your streak of 4 appearances. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Ben.
Pretty interesting, right? Daniel always has a viewpoint that is a bit contrarian and certainly insightful. If you want to learn more about Daniel and the work that he does, check out the show notes. Now, we'll be back next week with our Best of 2017 episode, which I'm currently putting together. So if there was an episode last year or this year, 2017, that is, or an excerpt of an episode that you particularly liked, there's still time for it to make the cut, but let me know. Time is running out. allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to do that. And if you haven't yet subscribed or don't know how, go to allthingsrisk.co.uk and you can do so there. Finally, if you like the show, do share it or give us a rating or review, especially on Apple Podcasts or iTunes. Thank you to all of you who have already done so. Enjoy the rest of the holidays, everyone. We'll be back next week with the Best of 2017. Until then, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.